please rise. Hear ye. All manner of persons having anything to bring before the Honorable Justices of the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware will now draw near and give their attendance. The court is now open. God save the state and the Honorable Court.
Morning, Judge.
Chief Justice, may it please the court. Srinivas Raju on behalf of the appellees. I would like to introduce to the court Mr. Peter John and Mr. Eric Liffendahl, both of the Williams, Montgomery, and John firm in Chicago, Illinois. Mr. John has been admitted pro hoc vice by the court in this matter, and with the court's permission, he will be making the presentation for appellees.
Welcome to Delaware, counsel.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'd like to introduce my co-counsel, Stephen Barley. Mr. Barley is a member of the firm of Hogan & Hartson. He has been admitted pro hoc vice, and he will make the argument on behalf of the appellant.
Welcome to the court.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's a pleasure to be here.
May it please the court. We are here to address two fundamental questions where we claim that the Chancery Court erred in deciding the dispute between the parties. One question is whether the breach of the access and support agreement was material or not. The court clearly found there was a breach of that agreement, and that finding has not been appealed and is not before you. The question is whether it was material or not. The second issue is whether SDDTI, if I can be permitted to use an acronym, has the ability to make claims on Mannesmann, and Mannesmann then in turn can make claims on my client relating to asbestos liability. Just to review very briefly some of the background of the agreements and the pertinent provisions, the asset purchase agreement, which was entered into in November 1994, in that agreement, IMO agreed to transfer certain assets to Mannesmann, including assets that had contained asbestos. As part of the agreement, IMO retained liabilities relating to those assets and potential claims relating to asbestos exposure. The agreement clearly permitted a one-time transfer of the assets pre-closing, as Chancellor Chandler found, to an affiliate of Mannesmann without my client's consent. That occurred, and then the assets were transferred to an then affiliate of Mannesmann, DDTC, which held the assets. The agreement also contained a provision prohibiting subsequent transfer of the agreement or the assets without my client's written consent, and there was supposed to be notification to my client in advance of that. Closing occurred in January of 1995, and at closing, the parties entered into the access and support agreement. The access and support agreement provided several material terms. One, that DDTC would maintain and preserve the turbine division. That's what was sold, the asset sold, turbine division records. It allowed my client access to those books and records. It provided that DDTC would cooperate in defending any asbestos-related litigation. And importantly, it also provided that DDTC and Mannesmann were prohibited from assigning the assets or the rights or obligations in the access and support agreement without my client's consent, which again, my client had to be notified in advance if such a transfer was to take place. Importantly, from our perspective, my client's yes or no on that the consent to the transfer was left to its sole discretion. Typically in these agreements, you'll have language along the lines of the consent shall not be unreasonably withheld. We don't have that here. We have an absolute yay or nay on my client's part. Unbeknownst to my client, some 6 years later, in April 2001, the assets were transferred, in fact, from DDTC to WestGen, which changed its name twice and subsequently became SDDTI. It's our position that that transfer was a material breach of the party's agreement. Importantly, in looking at the agreement last night and preparing for this, it struck me that the assets that were transferred to SDDTI, if I can be permitted to just use that acronym, the assets that were transferred to SDDTI included the very books and records that are the subject of the access and support agreement. If you look at Appendix 213, which is the agreement in which DDTC sold the assets to WestGen, you will see in there that the very books and records that are the subject of the access and support agreement were part of the assets that were transferred to SDDTI. So what we have in that situation is a transfer of these assets to a company which is not a party to the access and support agreement, SDDTI, a company that is not in privity with my client, and a company that my client cannot compel to give us the access and support that the access and support agreement supposedly was put in place to provide my client. There were a couple, subsequently, approximately a year later, my client recognized that the assets had been transferred without its consent. It is undisputed that consent was never obtained and appropriate notice was never given before the sale occurred. Once my client realized that in April of 2002, at that point, it ceased accepting the tender of any asbestos cases and has consistently rejected the tender of cases since that time. There are a couple of findings below that are not appealed, which are pertinent here. One is that there was a breach of the access and support agreement, and another is that SDDTI has no right to seek indemnification directly against IMA. Why do we contend that the provision preventing the assignment without my client's consent is a material provision? Why is this a material breach? Well, first of all, we have a very clear provision. It's a non-boilerplate provision in actually a very short agreement that provides that the assignment shall not occur without my client's consent. Secondly, that provision is in...
Well, what are the things that your client would consider in deciding not to consent or to consent?
Well, they were never given that opportunity, so it's very hard for me to say what they would consider. I would assume what they would consider is what is the nature of the entity to which the assets are being transferred. For instance, SDDTI is a Siemens entity. Siemens is one of the largest corporations in the world, as I understand it. They also have another subsidiary, Westinghouse. Westinghouse is a subject of many asbestos claims, as I understand it. So you have an entity that's affiliated with a known asbestos target, which is also a very deep pocket entity. Those two things would raise concern on my client's behalf. And I think they wouldn't have consented.
Would they consider, will we still have access and will we still have support?
They would, Your Honor, and that's exactly why it's very disconcerting that the very records that we are supposed to be having access and support to are not owned by the entity anymore, owned by the entity with which we have the access and support agreement. The access and support agreement is between IMO, my client, DDTC, and management. SDDTI is not a party to that agreement. So we have no privity to force SDDTI to give us the access and support to the records that were transferred to them as part of that sale.
So you're saying that if this case ends, that the next day they could say, sorry, you can't have access and support anymore?
I think that's exactly right. Now, whether they will or not, I don't know. They have represented they will not do that, but I don't know that. We certainly have no mechanism to enforce them to abide by the access and support agreement because they're not a party to that agreement. So they certainly could. And I'll take it a step further, Your Honor. There's nothing, as I see it, if the determination is made that this provision is a non-material provision, it's not material, the provision that permits my client to give the yay or nay on the transfer, then there's nothing that prohibits them from transferring the assets again. There's already been a finding that it's not material. So they could tomorrow, presumably, or the day after a ruling that would be adverse to my client, transfer the assets to, let's say, W.R. Grace. which is probably the number one asbestos target now, given they even have criminal proceedings against them relating to asbestos liabilities. So those are the kind of fears that my client had. And that is what made the provision material. Whether it is material and how it's being carried out today, in fact, I don't think is relevant to whether the provision itself is material. And I think that these concerns we have are not going to be alleviated simply because there's a representation or because there's a course of conduct to date that has permitted access and support. The third factor...
is there any consideration for that representation? Arguable consideration?
I don't think so. I mean, it was made in open court in front of the chancellor. I have no reason to believe that my brother counsel would ever make a misrepresentation to the court. I have the utmost respect for him. But that being said, I don't know what his client is going to do if they're not contractually bound to provide us this. And there was no representation that they're not going to sell the assets down the road to someone else, some other company. And that's the whole point of having control over the assets. The nature of asbestos liability is quite unique. I mean, it is probably the single largest source of litigation in this country. It's extremely vexatious. It has caused numerous companies to go into bankruptcy, and it, in fact, is so significant that it's been the subject of numerous attempts at legislation in the United States Congress, in the United States Senate, to deal with how problematic it is for U.S. businesses. And so it is a legitimate concern on the part of any party that is going to retain liabilities for asbestos in particular with respect to assets to maintain control over where those assets go and how they're treated. And that's what my client sought when it entered into this agreement. You will note that the non-assignment provision, as I call it, is contained in both the asset purchase agreement and the access and support agreement. Again, as I mentioned earlier, the ability to give the thumbs up or thumbs down on the transfer of the assets is in my client's sole discretion. In addition to that, the parties stipulated in their agreement that the breach of any provision in the agreement would constitute irreparable harm to the other party. That is in, I believe, Section 5 of the Access and Support Agreement. So the parties recognized that a breach of a provision would be significant enough that it would irreparably harm the other party to permit specific performance. In addition to that, the non-assignment provision was deemed so significant to the parties that if it was breached, there was a provision which provided that any sale without notice and consent would be void. So, I mean, you have all these things coming together to demonstrate the significance of this provision for my client. If I can take my last few minutes and I'd like to ask you to address.
Would SDTI be bound if, with regard to any future reassignment of the assets, if it were an affiliate?
I don't think so, because we don't have contractual privity with them. Our privity is with DDTC. Now,
have these assets all moved, as a in whole rather than in part? Has each subsequent transfer been everything that your client sold originally?
Have they? That's my understanding in reading the agreements. But perhaps that's a better question for Mr. John, because I don't know specifically. But that's my understanding, Your Honor.
So at least the assets and the books that you need access to have moved forward altogether.
They have to this point. But again, the concern is that there's nothing that would prohibit, as I say, a subsequent sale. And you know, that brings to mind there's nothing that would prohibit a subsequent partial sale of those assets. So they could peel off a portion of it. Let's say they wanted to peel off it's an international company. They wanted to peel off the German division or something and put it under the Siemens heading for whatever corporate purpose. I assume they can do that now if this is upheld. There has been an argument raised in response to our brief that we have elected our remedies and continue to perform under the agreement, and therefore we're prohibited from seeking its termination. I would urge your honors, if you haven't done so already, to read the ESPN versus baseball case very carefully. In that case, Judge Scheinlein of the Southern District of New York, interpreting New York laws as we are under here, found that in that particular case, where a party was in the midst of performing a contract and there was a breach of the contract, that it was permissible to go ahead and continue to perform that aspect of the contract that was pre-breach. And in fact, she went on to say that, in her opinion, that if parties were not adverse, then ESPN would be thankful that baseball had continued to operate under the agreement. And I think we're in the same situation here. I mean, we're supposedly being penalized for continuing to defend the DDTC from claims that occurred before there was this asset transfer, at least before we knew of the asset transfer.
And tell us again what consequences you submit flow from this breach. You're simply excused from having to defend.
If there is a material breach, then the agreement can be terminated. That's black letter New York law.
You're in your rebuttal time. What are the ramifications of termination? Your clients aren't going to be giving any money back to anybody, are they?
No, they will.
So we're talking about this aspect of the agreement that would require your client to do something is no longer operable.
Correct. That's correct, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Please, the court. I think it's important to go through the contracts again briefly because I believe counsel made one misstatement, and I think also that they weren't described to the extent necessary to decide the issues that the appellant has brought before the court. First of all, the asset purchase agreement, the APA, in this contract was between IMO and Manisman, not DDTC. That contract, the APA, provided that Manisman would have the right to purchase the assets for $124 million. There's also a provision, 2.4, that there was a $5 million set aside for the first 3 years to pay for the indemnification for asbestos liabilities. After 3 years, there was another $5 million set aside to pay for the asbestos liabilities. So those monies have now been paid by Manisman to IMO to pay for these asbestos liabilities that they're now saying they're seeking to terminate this agreement. Now, with respect to the access and support agreement, the ANS agreement, that agreement was between IMO and DDTC because the assets were transferred directly from IMO to DDTC, not to Manisman. Manisman assigned their right to the assets. So the two parties to the asset agreement were IMO and DDTC. Manisman signed the access and the support agreement only as a guarantor of DDTC's obligations to IMO under the agreement. So when DDT sold the assets to WestGen, which became just a name change, SDDTI, when DDTC did that, that was strictly a breach by DDTC, not by Manisman, because Manisman had no obligation. Now, the access and support agreement.
And what are the implications of being a guarantor? I would think if you're guaranteeing something that someone else has an obligation to do, you have an interest as a guarantor if they don't do it, don't you?
Yes, if they seek the guarantee against Manisman for that, which they've not done. In fact, they've not sought to avoid the assignment to which turned out to be SDDTI. They haven't sought specific performance, which counsel just indicated was a remedy that they could have with respect to this transfer. They've never sought to copy the documents, which is right under the A&S agreement. In response to Justice's question, under the A&S agreement, both Manisman as a guarantor and DDTC are still responsible to provide those documents to IMO and do on a continuing basis. And Justice, in response to your question, the documents are still where they've always been. They're with DDTC and SDDTI's building in Trenton, New Jersey, and access is freely and totally given at all times. What has not been mentioned by counsel in this argument is that IMO is only required to indemnify and defend any entity for their own asbestos products. And what counsel said, as I understood his statement, was that the transfer of the assets in November 1994 to Manisman contained asbestos assets. Did not. The record, the affidavits, everything before the court, there were no asbestos assets in the IMO group that were ever sold after 1985. The assets transferred to Manisman had no asbestos in it. Manisman, DDTC, SDDTI have never sold asbestos products. The suits against Manisman, DDTC, and SDDTI are all based on successor liability for IMO's asbestos products. So this is strictly an attempt to get out of indemnification for their own products, put in the stream of commerce for which there's liability.
What is the remedy if the assets are transferred one more time for any reason and access is thereby denied? What happens?
There are three remedies. First of all, the first remedy is, as in the support agreement, is to copy the documents. And up until 6 months ago, they've never requested to copy the documents. 6 months ago, they asked to request to copy the documents, but they've never come back to us. So we don't know what their position on that is. Secondly, there is specific performance of Manisman and DDTC to provide them with the records. SDDTI is an affiliate of theirs. It was a shell corporation where these assets were put into for some corporate reason. They're still there, still available, and still controlled by Manisman and DDTC. The remedy for them not selling again is specific performance. Then, of course, we've advised our clients it would not be advisable to transfer these assets without receiving consent, because we'd be right back before the courts again.
And why didn't they ask for consent here?
I don't know the answer to that factually. I think this matter was dealt with in Germany, and somebody just didn't read that they had the obligation to ask for consent. That's my understanding. One thing I need to respond to, because it's the focus of the materiality argument of the appellant here, and question was asked and facts were disclosed, which are just not accurate. First of all, Siemens is not a target of asbestos liability. They just aren't. Counsel indicated that Westinghouse is a target of asbestos claims, and they are. However, the Westinghouse asbestos claims were assumed by Viacom when they bought CBS. The Siemens Power Generation Group, which was what Siemens bought, had no asbestos liability for those products, the turbo products of the Siemens Power Group. It's all Viacom.
Is this all in the record somewhere?
No, but the counsel indicated in response to the question that Westinghouse is a target, and therefore, since Siemens is tied to Westinghouse at the Power Group, they are a target. That's just not accurate. And so I'm responding to the statement because in all of these asbestos complaints, Viacom is listed as the successor of Westinghouse as the asbestos liability, and they have a huge liability.
So I can take it then that neither counsel's representation about Siemens and Westinghouse nor the information you just given us in response is anywhere in the record.
That's correct. And what we point out in our briefs, Mr. Justice, is there is nothing in the record that says that SDDTI is an asbestos target. at any level. What is in the record, and it's A-194, is that SDDTI was a shell with no history until the assets were put there. I think a reasonable inference of why SDDTI and DDTC before it are included in these asbestos claims is because they have the name DMAG Delabal Turner Machinery Inc., which was IMO's division when they sold the asbestos products prior to 1985. So that's the reason this has followed us for some claim of successor liability when we have absolutely no responsibility as a producer, user, or seller of an asbestos product. Those were all in the
record. Earlier in your argument, and you were talking about several available remedies that, you know, your opponent didn't take advantage of.
Yes.
And as I understand, his response to that is perhaps those were possible courses of action, but the one they've selected is simply to say this is a material breach, and now we're excused from what would have otherwise been our obligation. So you may be advocating choices A, B, and C, and they say we've selected choice D.
Material breach terminates the contract, terminates both sides of the contract.
Well, that was
they're asking for just carve out this exposure of ours for indemnity from the contract, but leave all the other obligations on both sides and keep the $10 million that was set aside to pay for our expense and indemnity for these asbestos cases.
I understand that, and that was the implication of my final question before, you know, the opening ended. What do you, let's suppose they're correct. What do you think flows from that? That they return all the money and everybody tries to get put back to where they are? Because this, their suggestion seems to be we get to keep all the money that we've received thus far. However, we're excused from performing one aspect of the agreement because you breached one aspect of the agreement.
Right. I think they would have to, if their position is a material breach termination, they would have to return the $10 million that was set aside to indemnify us for the asbestos claims, because that was part of the purchase price, part of the negotiation, and that was the consideration for this agreement. And therefore, that's why you can't take out a piece and then keep both pieces. As the cases we've indicated, that's be a windfall to IMO.
So why would we have to return the entire $10 million when we're only talking about, you know, a discrete group of suits here? It would seem that they're still doing something for the $10 million, aren't they?
Well, so they have some suits that they're currently defending, a few suits before they stop doing it, including, as we've indicated, suits that were SDDTI was sued, where they readily accepted the defense and are still defending SDDTI in those cases. Their remedy here was to void the transfer. And the transfer means it goes right back to DDTC. And DDTC is the affiliate under the agreement for whom they have to defend and indemnify. So I think it's pretty clear why they haven't asked to do that, which is the exclusive remedy of the contract. If you look at 13.8 of the contract, the indemnity provision has an exclusive remedy for indemnity violations. The exclusive remedy for the violation they're talking about is to void the agreement. It's in both the APA and the access and support agreement. And, you know, their position is, obviously, we don't want to do that because then clearly we have no claim to get out of the indemnity agreement. The only way you can get out of the indemnity agreement is to say it's a material breach under these circumstances. And I think that's what the Chancellor understood when he went through his analysis to show that they are not damaged here. The only potential windfall here is for their benefit because they'll no longer have to indemnify and defend asbestos claims that they have created and solely they have created. When you look at the asset and support agreement itself, the initial six whereas clauses talks about access and support to defend asbestos liability claims against itself and against us. And remember, under the APA, IMO does not have an obligation to come in and defend us at the outset. They had the ability to let us defend ourselves and reimburse us at the end of the asbestos case for our defense costs and any indemnity or settlement that occurs. So we are the ones who are defending ourselves. In order to defend ourselves on the successor liability, we have to have these same records. SDDTI has to have them. DDTC has to have them. So practically, there is no way that we are ever going to do something with these records that won't make them available to all parties, because our claim is going to be back to IMO, and we need those records to show that we're your products. So they're solely protected just by the nature of the circumstances we've all found ourselves in. In the access and support agreement, after going through the whereas clause, it's talking about the issue of this is all about asbestos liability and defending ourselves and defending you from those asbestos liabilities. The agreement goes forward and talks about the ability not to assign. Council indicated that that was in their sole discretion. The first part of Section 10 of the APA talks about there should be no assignment of this agreement, the access and support agreement, never was, or any of its rights or obligations herein that may be made to any party by operation of law without the prior written consent of the party, the consent which may be withheld or granted in its sole discretion. No rights were done. The assets that were transferred were subject to the last sentence in Section 10. After you talk about IMO's right to copy them if we think about selling these other assets to anyone else. And they go on for about 10 lines talking about the rights to copy, how they can copy, how they can achieve copying. Notice that they want to copy them because you're going to transfer the assets. And then the last line says, and that such sale shall not be consummated without the prior written consent of the seller. And that's the one that DDTC breached. It wasn't the sole discretion. It was the one that we shouldn't sell them without their written consent. Now, why is that provision at the end of the whole section that deals with you have the right to copy them if you're going to sell the assets? Because they wanted to make sure they could come in and copy before the assets were sold. There's nothing in the record that said they wouldn't have consented to this sale to our affiliate, SDDTI, the shell company where these assets were transferred. We believe the reasonable intent displayed by that language is that you have to tell us about a sale so we can come in and copy, which is what the whole paragraph is about. And they have indicated that they might want to, but have never pursued it. So the remedy is void the contract, seek specific performance, seek Manisman and DDTC to comply with their obligations under the asset agreement as the Chancellor found they still have, and then you're fully protected. Even if you're not fully protected practically, because we have the same interests that they have in protecting and using these records, which we do. The only case that cited that a violation of assignment agreement leads to a material breach and allows you to terminate a contract is a case cited Forest Commodities Corporation by the appellant, which is a Georgia case under Georgia law. We all agree that this case is under New York law. And in the Forest Commodity case, there was no exclusive remedy to void the assignment. There was no election by the plaintiff to continue performance, which has been going on for the last 5 years, giving them access to these contracts. As the Chancellor found, there is no material breach of this contract that would allow them to terminate a contract, let alone to carve out a windfall for them by no longer seeking to indemnify us. New York law says that the breach must be so pervade the whole of the contract or have been so essential is substantially to defeat the object that the parties intended to accomplish. As the Chancellor found, we believe That is not the case here. If they are absolved from their indemnity agreements, there's only one thing that happens. They have a windfall, and we have no longer a defense for their asbestos products.
So, how would you characterize the object of the agreement?
The object of the APA was to transfer and purchase. The object of the access and support agreement was to have access to the records. This is exactly what the Chancellor found. And that access has always been there and always will be there. And if there's somehow a threat to do away with that access, there is a remedy to copy or to enforce. Thank you.
The reference to materials outside the record came in response to a hypothetical question, but I believe it's irrelevant whether it's in the record or not. The point is that by undertaking the steps that they undertook in transferring the assets from DDTC to SDDTI, a company with which we have no contractual privity, they deprived of us, meaning my client IMO, of a vital right that it had negotiated into the agreement, and that is the exercise of control over the assets.
Can the record reflect whether your client does or does not have continued access to the records?
The only reference, in, as I recall, is the representation at oral argument to Chancellor Chandler that they would continue to provide support. And I represented as well that it was my understanding that that as of that date, my client had been given access to the records. So that is in the record, Your Honor. This question of the...
Your opponent indicates that as a practical matter, you're always going to have access. Why isn't that so?
I don't know that to be so. I mean, there are many well-intentioned things that never come to be. The point is, if we believed that to be the case, we never would have entered into the access and support agreement. They could have just said, sure, you know, you'll always have access to these records. Trust us. Don't worry about it. But we wanted, because of the significance of the potential liability, the asbestos atmosphere in this country today, we wanted the assurance by contract that we would have a right to those records. That's what we negotiated. They were giving us assurance and representation that'll happen. We don't have a contract that that'll happen.
Well, is there any record support for the representation that the records started in Trenton, New Jersey, and they're still in Trenton, New Jersey?
No, Your Honor. None. And I don't know that to be true, and I'm not saying it's not. I just don't know. It's not in the record. This issue of the remedy, if there is a violation and it's found to be material, as whether you know, there's a termination of the agreement, or we go back to square one. I think 2 points are very important. One is that, and this is to your point, Your Honor, one is that the provisions on materiality permit a party to terminate the agreement if there's been a material breach. It doesn't say, New York law doesn't say you go back to square one and get a do-over and we have to give them the money back and they give us the assets back. You terminate the agreement. And so to point two, which is closely aligned with that, there are two types of, I mean, if you want to be very basic, two types of rights and obligations in these agreements. One is the rights and obligations that occur at closing. They pay us money and we give them assets. The second type of right and obligation are those that occur after closing. And that is this whole structure of indemnification, defense, and access and support. So what we're talking about here is a termination of those ongoing rights and obligations, not going back to square one and vitiating the entire contract. And that also is supported, I think, by the agreements, which each contain severability provisions providing that if one provision is invalid, it doesn't affect the other provisions. The last question that Your Honor asked was, to Mr. John was, well, what is the object of the access and support agreement? His response was access to the records. And while we believe there are other objects of the agreement, it's not just one object. certainly the fact that the records that he concedes were the object of the agreement have been sold and transferred to another company with which we don't have any contract would, I think, on its face, lead one to the conclusion that this was a material breach. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.
Thank you, Your Honor.